Hi, everyone, and welcome to Remaking Tomorrow, a series of conversations about the future of teaching and learning. I'm Greg Baer, the co-author of When You Wonder You're Learning, Mr. Rogers' Enduring Lessons for Raising Creative, Curious, Caring Kids. This is a podcast powered by Remake Learning, a network that ignites engaging, relevant, and equitable learning in support of young people navigating rapid social and technological change. On today's episode, I'm talking with Janae Henry Wood, Chief Learning Officer at Transcend, a national nonprofit that works with school and system leaders to design a world in which all young people can learn in ways that enable them to thrive in and transform the world. As Chief Learning Officer, she works to ensure that Transcend not only improves its efforts to reimagine schooling, but also shares its insights with the world. Janae, welcome to Remaking Tomorrow.
Thank you so much for having me. Such a pleasure to be here. And hello to everybody listening.
Janae, anyone who follows this podcast likely knows that the work of reform has been a decades-long effort, one that's seen different initiatives come and go, different presidential administrations come and go, and billions of dollars spent. And yet, when you look at the national data, the improvements we've seen don't exactly measure up. And you've argued that a main reason for this is that we've left intact, quote, the basic century-old industrial paradigm of how schooling happens, unquote. So what do you mean by that?
When I first came into education, I was 21, and this was in 2009. And I came in with all of the intention and fervor and desire to make change as a classroom teacher. And I was fully steeped and understood that that role was deeply important. I've studied international development. I've studied economics. I now have a much better sense of this question of education. But of course, as economists, none of us had a deep understanding of the social embeddedness of education. So I was a core member with Teach for America. Initially, I thought my life would lead to a life in academia. I thought that's the best life I can think of. And then I started teaching. And then I met students. And I saw up close two things happening. One is I saw deeply talented teachers next to me working their butts off. And two, I saw a system that was shaping all of our actions in ways that were great and in ways that were not great for young people. Seeing and experiencing education as a teacher, seeing it and experiencing education in my hometown of Atlanta with my brother. He is on the spectrum and he was receiving services or being diagnosed for them at the same time that I was a special education teacher. So I was very much able to see the system play out. As my altitude went up, I coached teachers, which was a misadventure. If any of the teachers I coached are out there, I love you and I'm sorry. I was on the knowledge development team by that time, working with Stephen Farr, who was the chief knowledge officer at Teach for America at the time. And we were trying to study and understand what separated Teach for America's most successful classrooms. The measures there, of course, were more limited performance on standardized assessments. But we wanted to understand what is separating those classrooms from other classrooms. And the thing is that after you go into hundreds of classrooms, really thousands of classrooms, and meet hundreds of teachers, you start to see real patterns. And as someone who came in with an economics brain, I like patterns, but I want to understand what they mean. And I don't believe in coincidence. So I don't believe thousands of teachers who are struggling all with the same thing. I don't believe that that could possibly mean that it was the individual teachers that were the problem.
So Janae, you were starting to see patterns that you felt were hampering good ideas. Is that right?
Totally. So let me give an example. In some classrooms where we were seeing teachers who were, let's just say, approaching literacy in a profound different way. These were teachers who had a ton of leeway in their school. So their principal maybe really trusted them. Their principal was aware of a lot of different theories of literacy training and development. And their principal felt a deep sense of conviction, for instance, that phonics is the way. And our teachers who were most successful were deeply entrenched in those environments, and that's where we were really seeing success. Our teachers who were in much more what I'll call very rigid industrial era learning, they were not seeing the same kinds of success. And I dug into the data to see what is really separating some of our most successful teachers. I'll give you an interesting tidbit. It was my favorite piece of data from that time that I've really carried on in my life. When we started interviewing our most successful teachers, so these were classrooms that we had already said, you have achieved significant growth on these metrics, there was only one correlative question. And it was the answer to the question, the students in this classroom are students that I would want my own children to know. That was the correlative question. So that kind of now tells us two things. We've got teachers who are operating in conditions where they have more innovative leeway, and we have teachers that believe that the young people they're teaching are valuable, worthwhile people that they would want children they love to know. Wow. We then have to ask ourselves, so what in the world is going on in this system? And then now that gets to the question of how do we think about and define the kind of system that we want versus the one that we have?
I'm guessing this is where Transcend comes in, to fast forward in your story from the teacher who had the up close view to the teacher coach to now working at Transcend, because Transcend seeks to reimagine the system, the model altogether, in partnership with educators, school leaders, and others. So what does that work look like?
So let me first define what that work is going towards, and then we'll talk about what it looks like. So the first thing I think that we accept in our work is that there is something called industrial era learning that is defined by and designed by an economy where work in factory or fields were the primary go. And from there, we then get a school system that is intentionally designed to look a certain way. So the first thing you have to accept is that the school design that we have has not been given to us by natural law, but we actually have inherited it from people who designed it for their purposes and for their needs. From there, we then asked ourselves, what are the things that we're ultimately going for young people? And there are two things that really matter. We're going for outcomes, certainly a more meaningful, broadened set of outcomes, where both intellectual development matters, where emotional well-being matters, where children have wayfinding skills. So these are the skills to set meaningful goals in your life and to have the will and skill to achieve them. Outcomes that are much more complex, that are attuned to the cognitive, social, and emotional and physical dimensions of learning, deeply important. But the second thing we realized is that experiences, thinking about the ways that young people interact and experience learning in themselves, between their peers, with adults, that was deeply important. So we asked ourselves, what are the primary experiences that define industrial era learning? And we came to about 10 of those primary features. And I won't go through it all, but it is really central to answering your question of how you do this. Industrial era learning is characterized by generally a very narrow focus. So this is young people focused on primarily the cognitive dimensions of learning. Do you know your reading? Do you know your writing? Do you know your arithmetic? The second experience is young people often experience deep irrelevance in learning. How many times have you talked to a young person or, you know, God forbid, been on Instagram, which I admittedly am on too much. But one of my favorite memes, like of all time, as a former teacher said, another day, another week, and I still haven't used Y equals MX plus B. There is something that we're doing both in curriculum and how young people are experiencing learning where it just feels deeply irrelevant to them. One of the things that most powerfully has to happen in this work is that we have to shift our paradigm from one that is a very industrial, output-focused understanding of what learning is, to one that is much more centered on full, comprehensive human development. And so we really work with people to, of course, make that cognitive shift, to understand that outcomes are both the experiences young people are having, as well as the soft and, quote, hard results that they are getting.
And Janae, as we think about this model to which we might move, much more learner-centered, we know that Transcend has identified some key lessons, and it resonates with Remake Learning, it'll certainly resonate with listeners of this podcast when we think about our guests over the years. It's not just the academic growth of every child, it's the cognitive and emotional, social, physical growth of every child. Another lesson about that wayfinding, about leading their own learning. And a third lesson about thinking about anywhere, anytime learning. Like, of course, schools are central in kids' lives, and so are online experiences and what happens in the neighborhood and after school and in libraries and museums and parks and in and across that learning landscape. Can you talk about some of these lessons in the context of where we might imagine schooling going?
So one of my favorite books by David Tyack is called One Best Model. Absolutely extraordinary history book. And it really traces the development of how we got to the model that we have now. And it made me deeply appreciate that we're not trying to replace one sacred thing with another sacred thing. The thing we're actually trying to do is to shift all of our perceptions from schooling to learning. So that really is thing number one. And once you replace the conception from schooling to learning, I can now appreciate all those things you just said. I can now appreciate, oh yes, like when we had kids doing virtual museum visits at the British Museum, you know, kids in Ohio during COVID, that counts. But you have to have that conception that learning is the goal. So I think the first thing that we have to think about in this new system that we imagine is that it goes from a physical-based building where things are happening to an ecosystem where people are working together to create learning experiences critically for kids, but also for the adults who serve them.
And Janae, if I had a podcast like button, I'd be pressing it ding, 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 ding right now, right? And it resonates so deeply because when I think about Remake Learning, the hosts of this podcast.
Yes.
When we think about 15, 16, 17 years ago, that simple shift of not talking about education, which immediately conveys schooling, but talking about learning, that simple, subtle little shift then prompted us to think about the learning landscape in the way that you described. Because yes, school is important and kids spend up to 20% of their waking hours in school buildings. So where are all the other places that they're learning? All around, if they have caring adults in their lives.
Exactly right. So if I were a listener and I'd be like, yeah, okay, Janae, like, okay, Greg, that's real cute. How exactly do we do that?
Yes.
And I think that that how question matters tremendously. So we accept that we have to expand our notion that experiences matter just as much. They are not conduits to outcomes, but they matter in their own right. Then I think we have to accept that schooling, we have to shift that language to be about learning. And then I think the next thing we have to really shift ourselves to understand is that communities are going to do this. And so something very important that we have been doing in our work and also trying to really codify and define and bring out more clearly is an idea of community-based design. Now, this exists in different fields that are doing different human-centered design work, but it hasn't really ever been applied in the way we're trying to apply it now to education. And the idea behind community design is saying that we are only going to get to those extraordinary and equitable experiences for all when all community stakeholders, this includes parents and caregivers, young people themselves, educators, important community stakeholders, are coming together in a design process to really create these kinds of experiences together collaboratively. We now live in a world where I believe it is not one system to dominate them all. It's many different systems and ecosystems working together. And I think that the heart of community-based design is also accepting the very networked reality that we are in, the ways that technology has fundamentally shifted the game, the ways that we can get at customization and personalization in education in ways that we really couldn't. And frankly, some of the lessons from the pandemic closures, just around how important the social aspects of learning truly are. We all need to be holding ourselves deeply accountable for the learning of our children, not sort of operating in a market approach where we hand them over to pre-K-12 and say, da 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 da, these are the outcomes we need for the work, make it happen, do it. We have to completely shift that mindset.
This is Greg Baer. I'm talking with Janae Henry Wood, Chief Learning Officer at Transcend. Jeanette, you say that communities are going to do this work of shifting us to mindsets that we think about learning and the learning experiences that we want for our young people in and out of school, early childhood through higher education. And so it'd be nice if we had roadmaps. Sometimes we get roadmaps in industries or fields because we've invested a lot in research and development. And you know well that our federal government, while authorizing hundreds of millions of dollars to support R&D, as it's known, in the education field, that support for R&D is dead last among federal agencies and subject matters in which we might be investing R&D. In fact, you've compared the R&D in education to the budget of Snapchat, which
right.
alone as a company spends more than $1 billion to find ways for teens to send each other digital photos. So it's just
wild.
It's wild and ridiculous how little we actually spend in developing those roadmaps. So where do we fill that gap? Where do you at Transcend turn and direct people in places all across this country?
Well, let's say I want to go on this journey. Where do I actually start? Like, just answer that for me, Greg. Like, where do people go when they're thinking the school's a mess? We've got to change the schools. Where do they go first? Where would you go first?
You might turn to a school of education or a local university. Maybe you find the right section in a bookstore. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's where people would go. Nope. That is not where you go. We believe that actually one of the first places that you go is students themselves. And this has been a deeply important part of the process that we have been creating and working with hundreds of communities to do. Something that is very important to our methods is what we call conversations with kids. And conversations with kids is really an attempt to ask them about those experiences that I named a little bit earlier. You can do this in all sorts of ways. One, you know, we've developed a survey where you can survey hundreds of kids at the same time. And we've validated this. We've had the questions worked on by a psychometrician. It's not something I like made in the bathroom. It actually is a real decent tool. And what it helps you to do is to ask young people, to what experience do you get to make choices about what you're learning in your classroom? To what experience do you feel loved by the adults around you? And when you ask about 50 of these questions to a big population of students, you are getting a wealth of data about how young people are experiencing their learning, what they hope could be better about school, and that actually gives you one of the most important starting places.
So, Jeanette, you love patterns. What are some of the things the kids are telling you?
Oh, this is my favorite question because I love bringing in just the voices of young people because they're so important. The number one pattern, and this is across thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of kids now, is what I brought up before, relevance. They're basically saying school is not actually focused on the things that most matter to me, that my friends and I most care about. Now, let me go on a slight diatribe about this because I think that this can be misunderstood. This is not to say that young people should not be exposed to things outside of themselves. Oftentimes, when I saw people teach in Black communities or interface with Black kids, of which I am a Black human, they would think the best way to get the kids to care about this is to make Shakespeare into a rap. Here we go. And then you get some cringy introduction to new material that is somebody doing a whole like rap gamut. Now, listen, that actually might work if you have a class where the children are deeply musically inclined and like, you know, they really love that and you built a relationship. But that is not exactly what we mean solely by relevance. Mm-hmm. And I do think that that can often be the first thing that people think is, okay, I've got to make it hip. I've got to make it cool. I've got to find, no. I think the first thing that we're doing when we're thinking about relevance is we're getting to know your young people a bit more as individuals so that that can actually be an opening scene to what that relevance ultimately looks like. I do not aspire for a world, for instance, where children in the US don't read Shakespeare or children don't engage with Beethoven or children don't read the incredible works of post-colonial writers and theorists. It actually is deeply relevant, but it's all about the framing, the questions, the goals, the experiences, how you're teaching it. Those are the things that make things more relevant.
It was the idea of relevance, and I also heard deep and caring relationship.
Yes.
With a caring adult. Is that another pattern, a theme that emerged from the things that the kids told you?
100%, but in more positive ways than you would think. Actually, very happily, like kids by and large are not thinking that adults dislike them or hate them. They actually do feel and want to feel more deeply connected. But the insight that we have to relate to that is something that the dear cognitive scientists have given us over the last 20 years, incredible insights, where we understand just how social learning itself is. And so we know that the idea of cognitive readiness, that you have to be able to regulate before you can relate, is deeply important. If it's true that young people are not ready to learn until they are out of their fright state and into a state where they feel safe, where they feel connected, where they can make mistakes. This is particularly true of children who face trauma. You have to create that kind of environment. That gives you a lot of different implications, Ben, for how we structure the school day. Because if I need to be making a bridge between home and school, one where some kids might come in either feeling hungry, feeling dysregulated, feeling fearful, feeling scared, that might mean that the first hour of school looks very different than the traditional design.
Janae, our listeners, I think some of them will hear in the things that you're saying, the things that my co-host Ryan and I talk about all the time when we talk about Mr. Rogers, someone who is grounded in what we would now call whole child theory and practice, mindful about the learning sciences of his day. And so I suspect that there are places that are not make-believe, but that are actual places here in America where
yes.
communities are beginning to realize what you're describing. Can you give us some hope? Can you point us to some places that maybe we should all be looking?
Yes, I can give you four schools that are top of mind. The first is Van Ness Elementary, which is in DC public schools. And this is one of my absolute favorite schools. It is another one of those schools where, you know, you go in, you don't have kids, and you're like, should I have kids for this environment? But Van Ness is an incredible environment. The former principal there, Cynthia Robinson Rivers, developed what they call the whole child model, which is centered on the idea that school is all about the well-being of students and that we ultimately have to nurture their emotional regulation and who they are before we can get them to a reasoning state. And so the entire school is really designed very purposefully around a three-tiered model. Some of their approaches are for all students. Some are for students that need a little bit more support. And the model is incredible and spreading. It got a grant from the government to spread it and study it in 20 different communities, and it spread to schools in Washington, D.C. That school is profound because I think it takes a really big leap that often can cause a lot of arguments in education circles, which is, who cares if the students are feeling good if they can't read? Who cares if they're going out and having recess if they don't know how to read? And I'm saying that a little bit hyperbolically, but we can all feel those tensions in education.
Unless kids know that they're loved and capable of loving.
True.
There's no great learning that's going to happen. So Van Ness, goodness spreading elsewhere. Where else can we look for hope?
Yes. So the second school that's on my mind, one of my absolute favorite learning environments, is a school called Intrinsic in Chicago. So this is a two-site charter school. And when I tell you, I have never seen a campus that is more academically rigorous and pushing on the boundaries of learning than Intrinsic. Intrinsic has done a profound job in remaking the experience of academics. So they have what they call a pod model, which was developed by two teachers who were both high school teachers, taught in Chicago public schools for about 10 to 15 years, also worked at the district. And one of the things that Ami Gandhi, one of the co-founders, said is, I always found when I was a high school teacher that I wanted to clone myself. I needed to be working with one group of students on this. I needed to be doing a writer's workshop with the students who were very high achieving. I needed to be doing remediation and like basic vocab and grammar with some students. Because of course, as we know, we get students who come with us with a lot of different readiness levels, a lot of different skills. And this is why customization is such an experience that we have got to move to in the new world, because the inflexibility of our current system, it is, you're either on grade level or you're not. And that really does have to shift.
Janae, you mentioned that you had four examples. I'm sure you have 44, but can you give us just one more?
The third example would be Brooklyn STEAM, which is a two-year program developed in partnership with the Brooklyn Navy Yard and New York Department of Education. This is a two-year career workplace model that takes young people in their junior and senior year, puts them in a real professional work environment on the Brooklyn Navy Yard in six different pathways, from computer science to film and media to cooking and hospitality. And they are doing on-site hands-on learning and getting tons of professional certifications while they are getting a Regents diploma. And this really sets kids up to have middle income jobs in New York City, which is one of the founder's biggest goals. So that is a wonderful example of what hands-on deep work preparation that is also rigorous and really cultivating and developing young people, not just putting them in a dusty basement and having them, you know, build a bookcase and call that workplace learning. It is profound.
Janae, as we close this conversation, we want to turn to a lightning round. We want to know more about you. So are you ready for a lightning round of fun questions? First things that come to mind for you. Ready for this?
I might be ready for this. So let's try it.
Here we go. You're a life member of the Oxford Union Debating Society. What's the debate you haven't yet had but would like to have?
Nation states. Failure or innovation?
And you are a cellist in the Oxford University Orchestra. What's your favorite piece to play?
Favorite piece on the cello is the first movement of the Prokofiev Cello Sonata.
Janae, how can people find out more about the work that you're doing?
You can visit our organization, Transcend Education. Now, there is another organization that is stopping us from being great. And so that's why it's Transcend Education. But we are just called Transcend. You can also find us on Twitter, currently known as X, at Transcend Built.
Janae, before we go, just one more question. What's one thing that parents and educators can do today to make tomorrow a more promising place for every learner?
One thing you can do today is have a meaningful discussion with young people about their hopes, dreams, and how they're experiencing school, and that will light a path forward for what you need to do next.
Thanks again to Janae Henry Wood, Chief Learning Officer at Transcend. Remaking Tomorrow is powered by Remake Learning. Learn more at remakelearning.org.